The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Johnson, Judge Reyes, Judge Cochran, the Honorable Matthew E. Johnson presiding.
Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. For the audio record, I will say that today's date is January 12, 2022. This panel of the court today has five cases on its calendar, three of which will be submitted by oral argument via Zoom, and two of which will be submitted without oral argument solely on the briefs. The first case set for oral argument is number A21-770, In Re BC Fox Trust. As counsel know, each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal argument, and appellant's counsel will have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal. Counsel for appellant, if you're ready, you may introduce yourself and your client and begin.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Joe Cassiope, and along with my colleague, Jade Jorgensen, we represent the appellant and petitioner below, David Fox. The respondent in this matter, Dr. Richard Fox, wrongfully modified the trust of his incapacitated brother, Gerald Fox, to divert specific assets then held in the BC Fox Trust to Dr. Fox. It is undisputed that Dr. Fox's motivation for doing so was his belief that he had not received an equal distribution of assets from the BC Fox Trust. The question presented to this court is whether Dr. Fox's conduct, the material facts related to which are undisputed for purposes of this appeal, whether that conduct violated the no contest clause in the BC Fox Trust Agreement, which voids the bequest to any beneficiary if the beneficiary, quote, directly or indirectly contests the validity of this trust or the distributions thereof in any manner. Now, to answer that question, this court needs to decide the legal standard that applies to no contest provisions in trust agreements, and then compare Dr. Fox's conduct to the language utilized by BC Fox in his trust agreement in light of that standard. So let's start with the standard. When the legislature enacted an entirely new trust code in 2015, it did not include in the trust code a specific provision addressing no contest clauses. So in the absence of a specific provision addressing the clauses, the court needs to look to different provision of the trust code to help guide its analysis. Specifically, it needs to look to section 501c.0105. And what that section does is it addresses the default rules set forth in the trust code and the terms of a trust agreement. What that section provides is that the trust code, so the specific provisions set forth in the trust code, as supplemented by the common law of trusts and principles of equity, that sets default rules. But importantly, those default rules are just that. And the section specifically provides that, quote, the terms of a trust prevail over any provision of this chapter, with the exception of 12 exceptions, none of which are relevant here. If the court then looks at the comments to section 105 of the Uniform Trust Code, and that became the intent of the Minnesota legislature when it enacted the Uniform Code, those comments explain that with limited exceptions, the rights and interests of beneficiaries of the trust are as set forth in the terms of the trust agreement. So what that all means in short is that in setting the terms of a no contest clause, grantor of a trust has significant autonomy to decide which conduct is and is not going to violate the terms of the no contest clause. Just like BC Fox here could have decided not to leave any assets at all to Dr. Fox, BC Fox had the autonomy, the right under the plain language of the trust code, to set the rules that would apply and the circumstances under which Dr. Fox would forfeit any assets to which he would otherwise be entitled under the code. So with that framework in place, the analysis this court needs to apply is really no different than the analysis this court applies in interpreting any trust provision. It's to look at the plain language of the trust in an attempt to ascertain the intent of the grantor. And words and phrases used in the trust agreement are to be construed according to their common and approved usage. One point I want to address, because how Dr. Fox responds to that is he says, I agree with all of that, but
Mr. Cassiope, before we talk about respondents' response, let me just drill down to paragraph 8 of the trust agreement. It seems to me the question is whether he contested a distribution from the B.C. Fox Trust, correct?
Correct. I would define it a little bit differently. A little bit differently. The question is whether he contested directly or indirectly in any manner a distribution from the B.C. Fox Trust.
And it seems to me that his actions with respect to Gerald's trust might have resulted in his, or perhaps did result in his obtaining funds that previously could be traced to the BC Fox Trust, were distributed from the BC Fox Trust to the Gerald Trust, and then were distributed again a second time by the Gerald Trust in a different way. But the distribution from the BC Trust to the Gerald Trust was unaffected. Would you agree with that?
I wouldn't, and here's why, Your Honor. On October 4th, 2017, so that's the date that Dr. Fox forced his incapacitated brother to change his trust agreement under threat of starvation. On that date, the BC Fox Trust had not yet been distributed. So the assets of the BC Fox Trust are still sitting in the BC Fox Trust. And that's important because the change that we focused on here is the change to the Gerald Fox Trust, which says any trust assets received by the Gerald C. Fox Trust from the BC Fox Trust Agreement shall be distributed to Richard B. Fox. So what Dr. Fox did...
By the Gerald Trust, yes. By the Gerald Trust, okay. Correct?
What? No. Your Honor, I was quoting the language. Any trust assets received by the Gerald Fox Trust from the BC Fox Trust Agreement shall be distributed to Richard B. Fox. And why I focus on that is, as of that date, those assets were still in the BC Fox Trust. As of that date, the BC Fox Trust Agreement was irrevocable. As of that date, the Gerald C. Fox Trust Agreement was irrevocable because Dr. Fox has stipulated he was incapacitated. So what Richard Fox did by his conduct is he specifically took specific assets, including a bank account, that was at that time sitting in the BC Fox Trust, and changed the distribution of that asset such that it would go to him instead of the beneficiaries, the Gerald Fox Trust. So this isn't a situation where assets went from the BC Fox Trust to the Gerald Fox Trust, and 5 years later, Richard amended the Gerald Fox Trust to put those assets in his pocket. Those assets were still in the BC Fox Trust. And it was Richard's intentional decision based upon the improper change he made the Gerald Fox Trust Agreement to specifically link those assets, to take a specific bank account then sitting in the BC Fox Trust and change its distribution, divert it to himself in a manner inconsistent with the way that BC Fox set up his trust agreement. That is the violation of the no contest clause. To be clear, also, Your Honor.
Can I just pursue that thought a little more? So I think you would agree that it's the change of the terms to the Gerald Fox Trust that resulted in the change of the distribution of funds. There wasn't any change to the BC Fox Trust.
Right.
And is there any language in the BC Fox Trust that controlled what the Gerald Fox Trust could do with assets received from the BC Fox Trust?
There is not, Your Honor.
So then how is a change to the Gerald Fox Trust, and I would assume you're arguing it's an indirect contest, how does that amount to an indirect contest? Can you help me out there?
I can. Let me give you a hypothetical. Let's assume that in March of 2017, 6 days before B.C. Fox died, Richard Fox went in, forced B.C. Fox against his will to change paragraph 7.C.4 of B.C. Fox's trust agreement to distribute that bank account to Richard. I think we would all agree that would be a direct contest to B.C. Fox Trust. So the question is, when Richard, 6 months later, forced the incapacitated Gerald Fox to change his trust to divert that exact same asset to Richard, is that an indirect challenge? We know it is undisputed, Your Honors. It is undisputed that Richard's specific intent, and you can look right at pages 10 and 11 of Dr. Fox's brief, his specific intent in making this change was to modify the distributions of the B.C. Fox Trust. He was upset that he had not received a fair share, and he decided to even out the distributions from the B.C. Fox Trust by taking a specific asset then in the B.C. Fox Trust and diverting it to himself at a time when Gerald Fox was incapacitated and literally was 6 days from death. And why that matters is because Dr. Fox, in his brief, makes the argument that, well, Gerald was free to make any changes he wanted. This really is two steps removed. It's not an indirect contest. That is, frankly, Your Honors, completely inconsistent with the undisputed record before this court. Gerald Fox, by Dr. Fox's own stipulation, was incapacitated. His trust was irrevocable. There is no substantive difference between my hypothetical, Dr. Fox changing the B.C. Fox Trust Agreement 6 days before B.C. Fox died in March of 2017, and Dr. Fox changing the Gerald Fox Trust Agreement to take specific assets that Dr. Fox specifically tied to the B.C. Fox Trust and putting those in his own pocket. B.C. Fox could not have anticipated every possible manner that Dr. Fox would take to challenge his trust, but he didn't have to. He drafted a no contest clause that that captured both direct challenges, like the hypothetical I provided you, and indirect challenges to the distributions from his trust. This fits squarely within the language chosen by B.C. Fox. And I want to address, Your Honor.
Just following up, what case would you point us to support your view that the term contest it would apply to a situation like this rather than just a legal challenge in court?
Yeah, I actually would look at all five of the primary cases, out-of-state cases that the parties have cited in their briefs. So the three Virginia cases, Hunter, Keener, and Rafalco, cited by Dr. Fox, and then the Simons Estate case and the Berry case cited in our brief. The Simons case from New Jersey, I think, is a very helpful one because in that case, the court decided that the beneficiaries' mere agreement amongst themselves to change the distributions under a will. So the two of the beneficiaries did not file a court contest, but the court in New Jersey decided that the mere agreement amongst themselves to change the distributions from a will, that constituted a contest in violation of the no contest clause. And the Virginia decisions, and I actually think this court should adopt the rule that Virginia applies in analyzing no contest provisions in the contest trust. It does construe these terms, such provisions, strictly, but it looks at the facts and circumstances of each case, and it looks at the specific language chosen by the grantor and compares that language and that conduct, that language to that conduct to determine whether the clause has been violated. And the Rafalco decision in particular, which is cited by Dr. Fox, I think is really informative. It's a 4-3 decision. There's three opinions. And but all of the justices agree, even the ones in the majority, that that there's no requirement that someone institute a lawsuit. In fact, I have been unable to locate a single case nationwide that adopts that rule that Dr. Fox is advocating, unless there's a specific statutory provision like Minnesota has under its probate code. But the courts in Virginia, courts in New Jersey, courts in Georgia all apply the same rule, which is you look at the clause, you compare the conduct to what's in the clause, and none of those decisions impose the rule Dr. Fox is asking for here, saying the only way one of these clauses can be applied is through a court contract.
Thank you, Mr. Cassiope. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you may introduce yourself and your client, and you may begin your argument.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Peter Hennigan, and I'm representing Richard Fox on this appeal. I have some prepared remarks and responses, but I also am happy to start with the court's questions, if it has any.
Yes. Good morning, Mr. Hennigan. I do have a couple of questions. First question is, do you think the language in the BC Fox agreement is unambiguous? And specifically the no contest clause language.
Yes, I mean, I don't think there's any ambiguity about what it says. It talks about, as most no contest clauses discuss, is a contest to either the validity or distributions of that trust. Now we can go on about what indirectly means. I'll be honest with you, I have not been able to identify a Minnesota court defining that. We've presented at least a definition from the restatement that refers to using essentially third-party proxies to launch a no contest clause as a way to get around it. I will point out that appellants have never offered a definition of what indirectly would mean. I mean, I think they mostly just want it to be a term that has no limiting principle and therefore can reach beyond this trust to the actions of another trust and another settlor. But I don't believe that the language itself is ambiguous. I mean, I think it's pretty clear what the intent of BC Fox was. It's a no contest clause. If you challenge the validity or distributions of this trust, you can forfeit your right to an inheritance.
Okay, thank you. That's very helpful. And so basically, if anybody either directly or indirectly challenges the distributions, I think it's more the distributions. I don't think there's an issue on whether the validity of the trust. It's more
correct.
The distribution.
Okay. Correct, correct. No, yeah, I would, I mean, Mr. Cassiope can correct me, but I don't think anybody is accusing Mr. Fox of challenging the validity of the trust. Right. The question is the distributions. And I mean, in simplest sense, the question they can't answer is how did the Second Amendment to the Gerald C. Fox Trust thwart any of the distributions of the BC Fox Trust? It didn't. Those distributions happened. It's what happens inside the Gerald C. Fox Trust that they have objections to.
Well, let me ask you about that then, because when I look, I'm looking at the Second Amendment amended Gerald Fox Trust, and under Article 3, it says, quote, any trust assets received by the Gerald C. Fox Trust from the BC Fox Trust Agreement dated July 1st, 1997, under paragraph 7C4 of the BC Fox Trust shall be distributed to Richard B. Fox. Is that a different allocation from the BC Fox Trust than what the BC Fox Trust originally had provided for?
Let me pull up. What the BC Fox Trust provided for with the residual assets, and we're really talking about the paragraph 7C4 assets. I mean, let me step back and answer this. There were two intents of BC Fox with respect to the Gerald T. Fox Trust. One is that Schedule B assets be distributed to the Gerald T. Fox Trust. That happened. That's not in dispute. The other intent was that the residual assets of the BC Fox Trust, and this is in paragraph 7C4, were to be split into two streams. 50% goes to David Fox, and 50% would go to the Gerald T. Fox Trust. Both of those events happened. David Fox received his, will receive, sorry, the assets have not been distributed because we're in litigation, but David Fox, regardless of whether the Second Amendment is upheld or not, will receive his 50% of those residual assets. The remaining 50% go to the Gerald T. Fox Trust, regardless of whether the Second Amendment is found valid or invalid. And now they're in there. And then the question is, you know, what happens to those assets? Without the Second Amendment, 100% of those assets go to the foundation. With the Second Amendment, half of those assets go to the foundation and half will go to Richard and his son. And clearly, the foundation has an interest in this. And the foundation has litigated its interest in California. And I will point out the foundation was dismissed from this case because it doesn't have standing.
Okay, so just in answer to my question then of whether this changes the distributions from the BC Fox Trust agreement, then is the answer yes, that it does change it, because now Richard Fox is going to obtain more distributions from the BC Fox Trust, correct?
No, it doesn't.
So Richard Fox is not going to get more distributions? I thought you said that he's get 50% now.
Right. He will receive more distributions.
Okay. And those distributions are from the BC Fox Trust.
Correct.
So why is that not a violation then of the no contest provision that says a beneficiary cannot indirectly contest the distributions from the BC Fox Trust? That seems like it falls squarely under the no contest clause.
Well, the question really comes back to, and this is really their key argument, is they allege what the intent of BC Fox was.
I'm not talking about that. Well, we only figure out the intent from looking at the language. You agreed that the language is unambiguous. It prevents somebody from challenging indirectly distributions that are made from the BC Trust. And here we have the Second Amendment, which changes the distributions from the BC Trust so that Richard Fox will get more distributions from the BC Fox Trust. And that language is directly in the Second Amendment referencing the BC Fox Trust and paragraph 7C4.
I think the problem, though, is you end up with, you have a gap between what BC Fox says the no contest applies to, and you have the Gerald T. Fox Trust distributions. If there was a unified plan, and BC
Fox... Why does that matter, Mr. Hennigan? It doesn't seem to matter, because what is at issue here is whether or not there is an indirect challenge to the distributions from the BC Fox Trust. And this seems to be an indirect challenge, not a direct challenge. I would agree with you there. I don't think this is I'm speaking just for myself, but I don't think this is a direct challenge, but it seems to be an indirect challenge, an end around to change the distributions from the BC Fox Trust to now give Dr. Fox and his son 50% of those proceeds, 45% to Dr. Fox, and John Fox will receive 5%, which is a different distribution of funds that have yet to be distributed from the BC Fox Trust.
I just simply disagree, because I think you end up with a situation, there's no limiting principle here of the tail of assets being distributed to another trust. If that can become a way that anybody can claim it's an indirect contest, then what do we do? What do we do with a fact situation where Gerald Fox had distributed his funds to another entity?
That's a different situation, though. That's a different situation. Here, we're talking about funds that have not been distributed already, correct?
That is correct, yes.
Yeah, the funds have not been distributed. So this is going to change the distribution of those funds. And in fact, that was part of the original claim that had been brought, the injunction, which the district court did grant. And the district court, in fact, said, hey, you know what? We're going to stop Dr. Fox from taking any action to change the distribution of assets from the BC Fox Trust. So that has already taken place. That's already part of the record. So that seems to be consistent with also the California case where the court there made similar findings.
Well, I would disagree. I would ask the court to look at the brief regarding what was said in both the TRO decision and the California court decision. I think opposing counsel takes fairly broad liberties with that. I mean,
I looked at those, Mr. Hennigan, and those seem to be pretty consistent. And it's also, I don't know if we even need to get there in terms of intent, but it seems like Dr. Fox was very clear on the day before trial what his actual intent was. He was trying to level the playing field so he would get more distributions from the BC Fox Trust.
I would direct the court to consider what the Vittorio case addresses, because I think this is opening up the can of worms about no contest clauses and why courts have essentially placed guardrails on this. Is that language used by individuals about what they intend to do, if that triggers no contest clauses, then we will have no end to no contest clauses in courts.
Well, Mr. Hennigan, can I stop you there for a second?
Sure.
Because I mean, I think your point is well taken that courts construe narrowly no contest clauses. And I think that's something we need to take into account. So I agree with you on that point, but at the same time, we do have to give effect to the language in the no contest clause. And the no contest clause language is written fairly broadly to cover a variety of different activities.
Well, all I have to say, Your Honor, is that I don't understand if the distributions happen as BC Fox intended, that the 50% of the residual assets went to the Gerald C. Fox Trust, how that implicates the no contest clause of BC Fox Trust. He didn't say that the distributions had to go to the Gerald C. Fox Trust and be distributed to the foundation. If that was there, then yes, there is a challenge to the distributions of BC Fox Trust. But what we have is BC Fox can't complain and wouldn't complain about the distributions that occurred because they occur consistent with his trust. Counsel wants to read into this requirements of that distribution that are not there. BC Fox could have said it must go to the Gerald C. Fox Trust and must be distributed to the charitable purposes of the Gerald C. Fox Trust. It didn't say that. It gave it to the Gerald C. Fox Trust without any preconditions, without any requirements, and that's exactly what happened. And I agree, the Gerald C. Fox Trust has a right to bring a lawsuit against Dr. Fox. And it has brought one, challenging what he did with its distributions. But I don't see that BC Fox, if he was alive, would say this in any way violated what I set out in my trust agreement. And we do interpret that language narrowly, and it's a tip-off how often they have to say broadly in their brief, because they know the only way they can prevail is if this court goes outside the norms of how we interpret no contest.
But we interpret the language, and the language is pretty broad. It says indirectly contest, and it says in any manner. It doesn't limit that. It actually has broad language. So we still are required to give effect to that language. Why isn't the in any manner language? Are you reading out the indirect and in any manner language then?
No. Not at all. The question still comes back to what was thwarted by BC Fox's distributions. The distributions are there. They happen exactly as B.C. Fox intended.
Well, the distributions are to the three children, and the Second Amendment changes the amount of distributions to the three children by giving Dr. Fox more than what B.C. Trust had and B.C. had intended, correct?
Correct, but Your Honor, I would argue that you are putting something into the trust that's not there, which is B.C. Fox saying, this is the outer limits of what I'm distributing to my children, and no child shall receive more than that. He gave money directly to the Gerald C. Fox Trust without preconditions. Gerald C. Fox Trust could have turned around and changed that and given it to the children differently. In fact, if you look at the Second Amendment, it gives money to David Fox's wife that was not in the original B.C. Fox Trust. That's not a violation. That's simply something that the Gerald C. Fox Trust through the Second Amendment chose to do.
But Mr. Hennigan,
can I just...
Judge Cochran, go ahead.
Your time is running short, but I have a quick question for you, hopefully. I think the record reflects that the California court found that Gerald was incapacitated at the time of the Second Amendment. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
So does that affect the analysis in terms of whether this is, you know, the Second Amendment is a contest to the B.C. Fox Trust Agreement because it talks about, or well, the distributions thereof, because it talks about contesting the validity of the distributions thereof in any manner. So why isn't the Second Amendment that was adopted when Gerald was incapacitated and a contest in any manner? Doesn't your interpretation render that any manner language meaningless under the facts of this case?
No, I don't. I mean, again, I think the issue is directly or indirectly contest in any manner. The intent was simply to not, I think it was to give some latitude about what a contest was. But again, I think we go back to the fundamental question is, what has been denied the B.C. Fox Trust by Richard Fox's actions? Nothing in the trust, everything in the trust has happened consistent with what is set forth. We can add in things saying, oh, well, we believe B.C. Fox didn't want his kids to get any more than this, but that's not in there specifically, and there's no limiting principle. We can say we think B.C. Fox wanted the money to go to the Gerald C. Fox Trust to then go to its charitable purposes, but that's also not in there. So, with respect to the validity of the Second Amendment, all of that has been litigated in California, and I don't think there was any assertion that Richard Fox was challenging the validity of either of the trusts. So I guess, I'm sorry, I'm not counsel on that case, but my understanding is that was not a challenge to it.
Mr. Hennigan, your answers to Judge Reyes's questions have left me a little bit confused because you talked about greater distributions from the BC Trust to Richard. My understanding was that that Richard's increased distributions come from, or the intent was, and the effect of the Second Amendment to the Gerald Trust would be to increase Richard's distributions from the Gerald Trust, some of which would be funds that previously had been distributed from the BC Trust to the Gerald Trust. So there was a second distribution. I mean, the funds could be, some of those funds could be traced to the BC Trust, but there's no additional distribution or increased distribution from the BC Trust to Richard as a result of his conduct with respect to the Gerald Trust. Is my understanding correct or not?
It is correct. I probably was trying to more directly answer it in the sense that we can all agree that the 7C4 funds come from the BC Fox Trust and that they, again, are split. Half goes to David and then half goes to the Gerald C. Fox.
Okay, but they the way you're saying that, it gives the impression like they are, the distribution from the BC Fox Trust is different. And I thought your whole point was that it's the same. BC Fox Trust distributes that money to the places where it was intended to be distributed by BC, and thereafter it's redistributed by the Gerald Trust in a different way because of Richard's conduct with respect to the Gerald Trust.
I think, Your Honor, maybe I'm making this confusing. Just to be clear, the residual assets have two different streams coming out of them. One goes to David Fox, appellant.
Understood.
Half of it went to the Gerald T. Fox Trust. And there it sits.
Right. And Richard's intent was to then, if it had happened, it would have changed the Gerald Trust distribution of various funds, including funds that had previously been distributed to the Gerald Trust from the BC Trust.
Well, what happens is once those assets end up in the Gerald T. Fox Trust, the Second Amendment, prior to that, 100% of those assets would go to the foundation. With the Second Amendment, half of those assets go to the foundation, and then half go to the Richard and his son. I mean,
Let me interrupt you so we can move along because your time is up. But I have one more small question, and that's what's your authority for saying that the no contest clause should be strictly or narrowly construed?
Give me just a second to get my notes. The authorities I would cite are essentially fourfold. One is we have a situation. Well, I'll point out.
Let me ask a more specific question, for the sake of time. Mr. Cassiopeia has pointed out that the trust code was amended in 2015, and that I believe he argues that there previously had been a statutory provision about strictly or narrowly construing no contest clauses, and that the new trust code does not contain such a provision. Is that true? And if so, is there any legal authority for narrowly or strictly construing such clauses?
I'm not sure I remember in his brief the statement about the prior version of the trust code. But what I will point out is that essentially their argument seems to be because the trust code says nothing, therefore the court is left to interpret it however it wants to. And it's clear from both Minnesota case law, which is Stisser, and also how the courts are supposed to turn to how courts of law and equity apply this, is that Minnesota courts just don't throw up their hands and say, we're free to interpret. They say, what are the other sources of authority? And since there isn't any real legal distinction between a will and a revocable trust, courts frequently look to treatises. There's a restatement of trust, says they construed narrowly. There's Bogart's Law of Trusts and Trustees. They should be construed narrowly. There's Naftalin, which is we have a forfeiture clause, and there's no debate that we do. Those are construed narrowly. And then we are allowed to look at the probate code, which narrowly construes no contest clauses and will contests.
Okay, which statute? That's my question. Which section of the code?
Well, the code directs that.
Which section? What section number?
Well, there isn't one in the trust code. It directs the courts to look to principles of law and equity when the trust code is silent. That's 501c.0106. And it says the common law of trust and principles of equity supplement this chapter. And I would certainly argue that Bogart's, which is the leading treatise on trust, gives the court a pretty good sense of what the common law of trust is. Okay. And they really don't respond to any of that. They don't respond to any of that in their reply brief.
Thank you, Mr. Hennigan. Your time has expired and then some.
Thank you. I appreciate the additional time.
Counsel for appellant, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you. I want to start by correcting three factual matters. First, Your Honor, the extent that I suggested in my opening remarks that there was a previous version of the trust code that dealt with strict construction, that I did not mean to say that. The previous trust code did not have a provision dealing with no contest clauses either. The reason I emphasize the new trust code is because of the primacy it places on the trust agreement, the terms of the trust agreement decided upon by the grantor.
And you probably, your apology is certainly accepted, but probably unnecessary. It's probably my fault. It's probably I misunderstood the origins of that rule. I thought it was in a statute and then perhaps an obsolete statute. And that was the source of my question. So anyway, please, please proceed.
There is a statute, 524.2-5107, that addresses solely no contest clauses in wills. And Dr. Fox has asserted, well, you should move that a few chapters over into the trust code. And for the reasons set forth in our brief, there's no authority and no ability for this court to do that. From a factual matter, the Second Amendment has been invalidated. Dr. Fox stipulated in California that Gerald Fox did not have capacity. And he stipulated that the Second Amendment was invalid. So that is done. Finished, complete. Dr. Fox can't contest that any further. And Dr. Fox has, in fact, challenged. I am counsel in California, and this is in the record. Dr. Fox has, in fact, challenged the validity of the Gerald Fox Trust. I want to pick up, though, on a point raised by Judges Cochran and Judge Johnson that Dr. Fox throughout has elevated form over substance in trying to compare these two trusts. These two trusts were both irrevocable. There is no substantive difference between Dr. Fox changing the terms of the BC Fox Trust Agreement to divert the seven C4 assets to himself and changing the terms of the Gerald Fox Trust Agreement to divert the seven C4 assets to himself. That is because this is not a situation, Judge Johnson, as you indicated, where assets were in the BC Fox Trust, they moved to the Gerald Fox Trust, and sometime down the line, Richard changed it to move those to himself. Those assets were still sitting in the BC Fox Trust when Richard did this, and the Gerald Fox Trust was locked and irrevocable at that point. That is why, that is the key fact here, and that is why the court in setting the rule for this and other new contest provisions in connection with trusts needs to really look at the facts and circumstances of each case and compare the conduct in that case to the language of the no contest clause. BC Fox prohibited any matter of indirect contest to his trust, and it is undisputed that if Richard Fox had gotten away with his amendment to the Gerald C. Fox Trust Agreement, an asset that it was at that time sitting the BC Fox Trust, that BC Fox had said, half goes to David, half goes to Richard. Half goes to David, half goes to the Gerald C. Fox Trust. That half would have gone to Richard. That is an indirect challenge. And we know, counsel said, well, if we do it based on intent, there's no limiting principle. The limiting principle is you apply the conduct to the language of the clause. And the intent here certainly matters because it informs why Richard did what he did, but ultimately the conduct is what matters. And the conduct here was an indirect challenge, end of story. And really there's no debate on that. I want to very briefly address, we agree that this trust is unambiguous and this clause is unambiguous. And what that means is that the court, in interpreting the language of the no contest clause, is to use common ordinary meaning. So in determining what does indirect mean, I'd point the court to a dictionary definition of indirect. It means not direct. It means not straightforward and open. It means not directly aimed at or achieved. Dr. Fox specifically intended to take assets out of the BC Fox Trust, put them in his own pocket. That violated the no contest provision, and this court should enforce that provision as granted to effectuate BC Fox's intent.
On the meaning of indirect, respondent cites the restatement, which defines it as meaning through another person. And I don't believe you responded to that in your reply brief. Do you have any oral response now?
I do. If the court looks at the restatement, that provided just an example of what an indirect challenge was. So it did not, if you look at the comment to the restatement specifically, it's an example. So doing it through a third party, but it certainly is not designed in any manner to be exclusive of any other means. And I'd refer the court to the case law cited by the parties, the three Virginia decisions, the New Jersey decision, and the Georgia decision for other types of indirect challenges.
So in your view, the timing of the distribution from the BC Trust to the Gerald Trust is significant. In other words, you're saying because his actions occurred before such distributions are made, are you saying that with respect to distributions already made from the BC Trust to the Gerald Trust, a different result might obtain?
What I'm saying, Your Honor, is if this had happened 5 years later, BC Fox Trust had completed its distributions, had wound up and terminated, and Richard had improperly attempted to amend Gerald Fox's trust, and that just happened to involve some assets that at some time in the past had been in the BC Fox Trust, I think we'd have a hard argument. What's different here, Your Honor, is the specific language chosen by Richard Fox, which specifically contemplates assets that were at that time in the BC Fox Trust, right? Any trust assets received by the Gerald C. Fox Trust from the BC Fox Trust shall be distributed to Richard B. Fox. That language, Richard wrote it himself as the lawyer. Richard wrote it himself into the Gerald C. Fox Trust. That language acknowledged the fact that those assets were still sitting in the BC Fox Trust, and he diverted those to himself. That's the key fact here, Your Honor.
One more question, if I may. And this might be outside the record, maybe not, but when are distributions made by the Gerald Trust? Are they does that trust provide that the trustee shall do so at a certain point in time, or has discretion to do so? And remind me again, who is the trustee of the Gerald Trust now?
That is in the record because the court does have a copy of the original Gerald C. Fox Trust. It's an exhibit. It's exhibit L to the petition, which is at document 83. So that's in the record. It does not specifically address that situation. And so the court in analyzing that question would apply, normal terms of trust administration, which are in a trust like this, and the court will see this based on the way that this trust is set up. In a trust like this, the assets are to be distributed in the ordinary course once trust administration is wrapped up. This is not a trust where these assets are to be maintained for 30 years and distributed out. This is a testamentary trust such that it's in essence a will substitute. So once the trust administration is finished, which can be pretty immediately, or it can take a couple months if there are tax issues, those assets go out to the beneficiary. So it is in essence the equivalent of a will substitute. And then,
excuse me, I thought the Gerald Trust was an inter vivos trust. No,
it is. The Gerald Trust is an inter vivos trust, an inter vivos revocable trust, and the way that it operates, and you'll see this in Exhibit L, is that upon Gerald's death, the assets are to be distributed once administration is finished to the beneficiaries.
Okay.
The beneficiaries for the foundation, and then one of a niece and nephew of Gerald.
Okay. I think
after Gerald, to answer your other question as far as the identity of trustee very briefly, after Gerald died, Richard asserted that he was the trustee, and he remained in that position until he was removed by the court in California in October of 2019. Since then, the trustee of the Gerald C. Fox Trust has been Bank of the West, which is a financial institution in California. And because there's litigation involving the Gerald C. Fox Trust, all of the assets are still sitting in the trust, but the Second Amendment's been thrown out by the court, and Dr. Fox has stipulated to that.
Thank you, Mr. Cassiope. Thank you to both attorneys for your arguments. The case was well argued, and